All right, guys, here's another episode of South Sudan and the World, and we're going to get right into it. We're having such a great conversation. We have with us the one and only Mr. Jacob Idra. We're going to be discussing a lot of stuff, attitude, life, drive, and excellence, as always. And my guest today, he epitomizes excellence. He's a graduate of Creighton University. He is currently the founder and executive director of Ross Leaders. He's a player. So we're discussing mind. I think this is a good topic to start with. Share what you were saying about the mind.
Yeah, man. I mean, I was explaining a call that I love the and I really get inspired by the stuff that you're doing, and in our conversations, it always comes back to mindset as the difference. You know, and when you start to find out that internally is where the battle is when things start getting fun. And when you start to look in the mirror and say, okay, every decision that I make is going to impact what my future is going to become, is when you start to become really aware of everything that you do from the time you wake up to the time that you go to sleep. So as I was sharing with you, it was just as recent where someone was explaining to me, and it was a pastor, I'm listening to his sermon, and he says, you have your spirit, you have your body, and then you have your soul. Encompassed in your soul is the psyche, you know. Encompassed in your body is the mind. Because, you know, your body has your brain, and your brain is just like a muscle. You're working your muscle out, your brain. And if you neglect your brain, then it's just like any other muscle. It's going to become weak. And then you have your spirits, and you have your negatives, and you have your positive spirits. And these spirits can influence you in one way or the other. And so you have that spirit that tells you, Akol, you know, you don't have to work out today. Yo, Akol, you could skip this. Like, you know what I mean? Like, you can wait till tomorrow. But then you have that part of your spirit that's telling you, that inside voice that's telling you, Akol, you have to work out today. You got to go get it in. If you are going to skip today, you're going to pay for it tomorrow. And depending on which one you listen to, if you listen to the positive or to the negative voice in your head, determines the strength of your mind, determines the strength of your body. And then all of that determines the where your soul goes, you know? And
it's
so
crazy you say that.
It starts to get fun, man. When
it
you start
gets deep. You know, it's so crazy, right? So cycling. I was explaining to somebody, he's like, what do you like about cycling in South Sudan? I'm like, the road we go on, there's no traffic. It's a newly built highway in South Sudan. Like, people don't drive on the highway because it's still it hasn't connected to the nearest, to the next biggest town. So it's like, you're going on this highway and you know there's no transportation, there's no place you can stop. You can't stop. And what we do is we go to location. So we go from Juba to Kuda. Kuda is about 35 kilometers from Juba. So we get there, we take a break, then we come back. So when you're cycling, the further you get away, the more you know, like, I gotta go back. And when you're coming back, you're like, I actually have no choice but to pedal and get back home. That's the only choice I have, because either that or I walk back home. Cycling is quicker. So what's so crazy is, like, those days when you're just like, so Sunday I really pushed myself. I wanted to do 100 kilometers, but I did 85. So I haven't cycled in 2 months. So I'm like, I need to push myself. And I do this thing where I exercise, and I'm really trying to start doing things where I'm like, okay, I need to get my mind just to do it. And so when you're on that bike, pedaling, you'll be on the bike for an hour and a half. And you're like, bro, I'm literally just pedaling. Then you're like, wow, my mind is so strong. Yeah. I did just something redundantly, and I just maintained focus. So people can say you can have your headphones, but you still got to pedal.
I got to pedal.
And then it's like, I think you saw in the doc, in the thing I posted, the wind hit us, man. That wind hit me, and I was like, oh my God.
Yeah.
Like, I was going at like speeds of like 30 kilometers an hour. I went to like 19. And I'm like, I'm pedaling. And what I do also, I have like speed metrics I got to meet in my mind. Because I have like the Samsung Health. So it's like, so it'll be like, oh, this kilometer, you went 28 kilometers an hour. I'm like, okay, I need to maintain between 27 to 30. If I go below that, that's another mindset thing. So when I first started, every time I got to get better. So I look at what's my average speed this week, next week, I got to do, if it's even 0.1, I got to do better. You start to realize, like, I can do something if I just switch my mind to it. You get to the point where, you know, when you start doing something, when you don't want to do it and you just do it because you force yourself to do it, you're like, man, that's a whole nother realm.
Right.
And you're like,
right,
whoa, that's it's like a weird energy you tap into. Just like, yeah, I don't care how you feel. Get up and go do it.
Right. Right. And it's fighting yourself. You know, it's you against you, you know? Like when I've been, you know, like when we were growing up, of course we played basketball. We played team sports, you know? Uh-huh. And one of my point guards growing up, he played golf. And I'd always be like, yo, John, like, this is not a sport, you know? You guys are just so out there hitting the ball. Like, who are you going against? It's just you against you. Like, this is not a sport. And then John was like, okay, Jacob, like, spring of senior year, he's like, come and play golf. And man, Nicole, I went out there and I played golf. And then I was like, wow, this is really a sport. And it's a sport of the mind. It's a sport of the mind. Basketball, a lot of times, you know, it's not until after you stop playing basketball for a while that you understand how much the mental piece of basketball plays to winning games. But when you play golf, every swing is mental. Every swing. You don't have a choice. Every swing is mental. Your last swing determines your next swing. And, you know, it's just all a mental game. So if you keep thinking, oh man, like, I had a bad swing, then, oh, okay, you're going to go into that next swing and you're going to have a bad swing. You have to completely clear that shot out of your head, whether it's a good swing, whether it's a bad swing. So the mental game is really a fun game once you start to realize it. And
it's a game that I feel like people don't, as you get older, you start to really realize that what makes the greats is not their talents, that they have that. But at some point, you realize, like, when you watch the NFL or the NBA or anything, they all are about the same level of talent. See what I mean? You can jump high, you can shoot the ball, you can play defense, but then it's like the attitude just separates you.
Yes.
Like, I always tell people, like, LeBron James has been doing what he's doing at a high level for 20 years.
Right.
Like, when LeBron James was drafted in the NBA, I was 8. And I'm 28 now. And he's like,
wow, God, so, I was 4.
So, like, I'm like, so I think about them, like, that means basically you have to be great. You have to be doing it at such a high level, but also a long time. So it's like, when all these young guys always, you know, when you get some fame at a young age, you're like, but the greats, consistency, the greats, like, you want to get to the point, Jacob, when you're like 50 or 60s, to have catalogs of work that you've done. Like, I did this, I did that. Like, people, we love people like, yeah, I did this. You look at Tom Brady. Tom Brady drafted in 2000. He retired this year. He was drafted in the year 2000. That's the year that I came to America.
Okay, that's all mental. That's what separates
them. And he
them.
Retired it's in like, 2020. So, like, 22 years is like our adult years. You can say it starts when you're in like 22, 23. I would even say that. So imagine from 22, 23, like, you now, you're 24, doing what you're doing until you're 44 at a high level.
And not
it's
letting
a different
up.
Beast.
And not letting up and staying up with the times.
Facing challenges, doing whatever, and keep coming, bouncing
going
back
through
every
injuries,
season.
You know, their injuries are our failures. When people tell you no, when you failed, when you've, you know, fallen off, when, you know, other competitors come in the game, like, and they're trying to take your spot. Like, life is really a reflection of sports, man, if you really start to
That's
look
why,
at
like, it. I always think about it. Like, I tell people, like, so, like, when I was in the States, I just started studying sports figures, coaches, athletes. I like coaches a lot because coaches is a philosophy. Some people have been coaching for so long.
Yeah.
And I always got, so I started studying successful people, like any craft, writers, whatever. It's it's just consistency. Like, you know, like why I started like my podcast and YouTube is this is because I told myself something I've always wanted to do. Just do it. Just do it.
Yeah.
Like no more excuses. Like,
right.
I'm just like, I have to just do it. Right. Thanks. If I got to publish an episode without music or just audio, nope, I'm going to do it because I need to just do it. Right.
Yeah.
Because like I watched Joe Rogan, like he's been doing this thing for 2009.
Yeah.
So I'm like, my attitude and my mindset is not the destination, it's just the process. Like you're now but the third interview I've done, right? I'm learning a lot about editing. I'm learning a lot about podcasting. I'm learning a lot even about conversation. And it's like, I'm getting a hang of things. Like I'm feeling it. I'm like, okay, it's kind of like sports. Like, you know, I'm watching my own film. And that's why I realized that's why we love sports, because sports is the only time you get to correct yourself. Like, but we should apply that in business. In your work, like, how can I keep refining myself? Okay, I don't know this. How do I learn it? Like, and you find how smart you become, and you just got to have a process. So I wrote down all the things I wanted to do. I'm like, what's stopping me from doing them? Okay, I've always wanted to talk about politics or economics. I literally, when I was in, let me tell you a funny story.
Yeah,
in 2013, I graduated high school. You guys know my age now. I had a classmate in high school who we were together in film club, who told me, you should start a YouTube channel. You're like really smart about what's happening in the world, just talking about your opinion of things. I'm like, but that's nothing. So he made me write a script. I remember in 2013, he's like, it was supposed to be called The Unimportant Important, what I call a dog. And he was going to be like, he wanted to become in. He's like, hey, I see this. I want to like, I'll do video. So you just focus on writing your scripts and doing the show. I'll edit everything. And so, because we used to do videos together and skits and all this. I'm like, no, I don't think I'm good enough. Okay. Yeah. That's 2013. This guy created a YouTube channel. His YouTube channel got up to 500,000 subscribers.
Wow.
His channel was taken down, and then he created another channel. That channel now has 170,000 subscribers. Wow. So I'm like, because he believed in himself.
Yeah.
I just, like, but imagine, like, I tell myself a call. Imagine in 2013, you just said, I'm going to upload one video.
Yeah.
Talking about what's happening around the world.
Right.
In 10 years.
Right.
And this, the guy who's telling me to do it is like, you have some talent, and he went and honed his talent, and he's thriving. So let me, like, do you feel like sometimes you sell yourself short like that? And that's what got me, like, I sell myself short. Like, there's instances where I'm scared to apply for something. I'm scared to apply for a project. I'm scared to do something because I think I get rejected. Do it and get rejected. Like, I reflect, and it's like, that's what drives me now, is that you sold yourself short for so long, it stops now.
Yeah. I like that. And, you know, I'd be lying if I told you that I do sell myself short, because I did at one point, but I don't anymore. And what I mean by that is, like, when I was in high school, I had an opportunity to apply to any college that I wanted to. You know, I was a fairly good student. I think if I would have applied to more high level schools, that I would have probably got in. And everything happened the way it did for a reason. But I felt like I was telling myself and comparing myself to maybe some of my peers who, you know, I went to a pretty highly competitive college preparatory school, and I had some brilliant classmates. And maybe I was comparing myself to them too much instead of seeing the value that I brought, because there were some other spaces where I brought more value than they could. My skill sets were higher than theirs. And there's some spaces where their skill sets were higher than mine. And in today's world, you want a workspace that is very diverse in thought and very diverse in skill set, you know? And so the analysts at your workplace may not do as well as the person who could develop relationships. And both of them are just as impactful to the deal that you make, you know? And so if I would have recognized that early on, then I would have probably applied to a lot of those schools, but then after I did, I had great mentors, man. And my mentors, I think, were able to instill, and also my experiences, like in playing basketball and experiencing failure and experiencing injury, and all that, just and experiencing death as well at such an early age, that I was like, what's the worst that could happen? I could fail, you know? And so even in college, like, you know, I was pretty confident in my abilities. I knew what I was good at. I knew what I wasn't good at. And even, you know, in, you know, after graduating college and applying for different positions, which ultimately I decided that I was going to start my own organization. But that all came from having the confidence in me that I could learn just about anything that I put my mind to. And so, and killing, and it's still in the process of killing that self-doubt, you know, that spirit in your head that's telling you, yo, Jacob, you can't do this. Hey, this is too big to accomplish. But now I understand the process of, you know, starting something new, of learning it. And, you know, back to like when I was in high school, I had a biology teacher and I struggled in biology. I just, the sciences just were never my thing. And he used to always say, you're coming to school to learn how to learn. And I took that with me. I didn't really understand it as a freshman in bio or a senior in anatomy, but that's life, is you're just learning how to learn. You know what I mean? If you can really perfect that process or work towards perfecting the process of learning how to learn, then you could accomplish just anything you want to in your life. And I really believe that, you know, like you've probably heard this 1,000 times, like all the buildings that we see, all the skyscrapers that we see, they were once not there. Someone had to
somebody envision, built them.
Somebody before they built a code, before they put, you know,
somebody had to vision like I want it like this. I want it like
they
that.
Started to dig. They had a vision, and we all have visions, but the difference is the people who believe in their vision and the people who take action and say, "Okay, I'm going to make this vision a reality." And all the things we're talking about, mindset, being persistent, having discipline, these are the people who ultimately build buildings. It's because they had those type of traits.
And, you know, it's so interesting. And like, and I'm getting into this where I've expanded my frame of thinking to like 5 years, 10 years, you know, longer. Like recently, I think you saw Charlie Munger died. You know, rest in peace. I love Charlie Munger. It really, I love reading his stuff. So he's been at the same company in his position for 47 years.
Mm.
Right. So Warren Buffett became a millionaire. He was 50.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when did a billionaire? He was 50. Yeah. So like, let me look at that. When did, so he actually originally came there when like he was an owner of the company. He was a lawyer, and he went through a lot in his life when he was 28. You know, he was divorced, and then his son died. And he died at like 99. So I always think like that long-term mindset keeps you sane. And you know what's so crazy? Success is boring. Like if you were to look at LeBron or Jordan or Tom Brady's or any great schedule, it's a pretty boring schedule. Train, eat healthy.
Yeah.
It's not exciting.
Yeah.
But you got to do that for a long time. I mean, you have LeBron like sitting courtside eating like snacks and stuff.
Yeah.
He's on a mission. It's like success is boring, but also success is for outcasts. You're an outcast.
Mm.
Like, I can't pull up with y'all like this. I got things to do. I have a vision.
You got to make some sacrifices.
You got to make sacrifices. And it's like some of the sacrifices is I won't have a lot of time for things.
And success is boring, and success happens in the dark. You know, in the dark. Like, and people sometimes are afraid of the dark. And one of the things that I always say to my kids and to my students that I coach, and even to my peers, is you have to go through the dark in order to see the light. Like, you have to.
Yes.
This is biblical. You know what I'm saying? And, you know, the light wouldn't exist without the dark, you know? Like the sky wouldn't exist without grass. So we got to start from somewhere. You know what I'm saying? And I think the people who are willing to embrace that early are the people who will one day see success. And we won't ever see the end of our success because we will continue to succeed and reach new heights and reach new limits. But it's a part of that embracing that process of, okay, I'm going to do all the little things. I'm going to do all the boring things in the dark. So when that light comes on, that I will be able
not
to perform
fun.
The highest.
I mean,
you know? Because you know, if you don't prepare in the dark, then the light comes on. And then
you'll be
ready.
Exposed. And it's one of those things where part
ready.
Of the dark.
Now you're exposed, you know? So, yeah.
It's like, embrace like think dark. About it like this, studying.
Yeah.
I always remember, you remember when I was like, I did Mr. South today. I never wanted to do it. I just thought it was something to do. Then I went to winning Miss Africa. I felt like I did well because I was just like, okay, I look at the criteria. What do I have to do? Oh, I have to know how to talk well. Goal pose. I'm like, okay, I already work out. So people are like, you have such a good physique. I'm like, what do you mean? I'm like, I used to work out like 4 days a week. I used to have a strict diet. My family used to complain about it. And it's like, I remember I used to no sugar. I went like 8 years not drinking pop, not taking added sugars. Like, but people don't see that. People don't see I used to wake at 5 a.m. and go to the gym. People don't see that I used to count my calories. I had a notebook where I'd be like, how many proteins, how many carbs, how many fats did I eat? People don't see that I used to count, I had a notebook of my workout. People don't see that part of it. They see like, man, you were in the stage posing. You won Miss Africa. Yeah. Like, how did you do that? Like, people are shocked. I'm like, God, I don't even know how to do it. But then I was like, it's a process. And you know, these processes is when you think about it, it's just sustainability. That's why I like cycling, because cycling, when you look at a ride in like 85 kilometers, like imagine like that's like 50 miles for imagine you just look like 50 miles I want to be on this thing. 50 miles is like what, Lincoln to Omaha?
That's exactly.
So imagine basically I'm gonna cycle from Lincoln to Omaha. Like mentally you're gonna be scared, like that's a long ride. But then you 1 kilometer, 2 kilometers, 3 kilometers, 4 kilometers, then you're like, wait a second, I'm on 10 kilometers in and 20 kilometers in.
Yeah. Do you guys decide before you get on how long you want to go?
We have a route and you can go longer. Like what I did, actually, our route was actually like 75, but I went more. Like I went past our point and then came back.
Yeah.
So like we decided we have every Sunday set location. We try to get at least 50, 60 kilometers
for
training. But like once a week, we try to do like 120 kilometers. We go to Tetekeka. That's 120 kilometers. Yeah, I mean,
wow. Yeah, it's interesting. You know, to your point, like sometimes and this is why I asked, I had a mentor who once told me, like, sometimes you have to jump to realize just how far the level is that you'll land on. Sometimes you just got to jump. You may not know, you just got to go. And he's like, sometimes, Jacob, even if you knew the challenges that were ahead, then you wouldn't jump. But if you don't know the challenges that are ahead of you, you're going to be more willing to jump. And so I was asking him, and I'm a big proponent of mentorship. I think mentorship can save you years off of your life. And I think it has done that for me. And so in the same breath that you're talking about, it's like, if you just keep going, you're going to overcome new challenges. And this isn't anything in life. You're going to overcome new challenges that you wouldn't have been able to overcome if you didn't just jump, if you didn't just get on and cycle for 50 miles. See, you were trying to go for 50. Now you were like, oh, I could even go longer. You know what I'm saying? And so,
the first time I sat, it was like 40 kilometers.
If you would have been thinking in your head, oh, man, like if you would have been thinking of it as 50, like I got to go on 50 miles. But no, you were thinking of it 1 mile at a time. I'm going on a journey. I'm going to keep going. I'm going to embrace the challenges that come with it. I'm going to stop if I have to, but then I'm going to keep on staying persistent. And sometimes I think we're just a little too scared to jump and really scared to take on the journey and take on the challenge.
And you know what it is, right?
Sometimes you just got to take it on blindly.
Just to do it. Like, honestly, like, for example, I started this podcast. I one day was just sitting. I was like, oh, South Sudan in the world. Why don't I just talk to people around the world, different South Sudanese, I'm in a youth situation. I grew up in America. I live in South Sudan. I have friends in diaspora. I can get voices of people. But then something told me was stopping you from doing it. Oh, that's like, I should write a proposal. No outline. What do you need? Okay, I need a mic. I just got to have a mic. Just okay, reach out to people and interview them. And I remember I told you, hey, you know, can you, do you want to, I told you I'm working on a podcast. Do you want to be a guest? You know, just reach out to people. And you know what's so crazy about this process in the beginning? Mm. Like when you have to ask somebody to be a guest and do their scheduling, you're like, man, you get frustrated. You're like, man, this is technical. But like, I have to keep going. Right. I got to find ways, you know? So, I mean, it's really there. But I was like, as we get into like, tell me going, about your journey.
And I think people too. I think people too, like, I'm a type of person who I understand the failures within the process. And so you got to just be able to jump and be willing to fail and sometimes fail in front of people. Like it's a part of it, you know, and continue to learn.
You got
to
miss those game winners.
Like you said, Nicole, watch that film, continue to get better. And, you know, Rick Ross has the quote, "You wasn't with me shooting in the gym." Like, I love to be that coach that is there with that kid shooting in the gym when nobody believes in him, when he's the underdog. You know,
and
what
you
I mean?
See that fire in their eyes. You know, those kids, you're like, you are going to be successful. You have an attitude. Bro, there's this small little kid like
that different chip. Even,
by the way, you got me coaching. Man. They want me to coach some small team. I was you got me inspired to coach. They want me to coach small team.
You gotta do it. You gotta do it. You gotta do it.
You just see some kids. And it's like, but like let me ask you this. Okay. Self esteem. All this comes down to self esteem.
Mm-hmm.
Growing up as immigrants, do you think we had to build our self esteem? Like, tell me about your experience. Like coming to the U.S. Were you born in the U.S. or were you born in Africa?
No, I was born in Khartoum.
Yeah. How was that like? And how did that affect your journey?
Yeah, I was born in Khartoum. I don't remember much in Khartoum in Sudan when I was born there in 99. Then my family went to Cairo. And these were my first visions in Cairo. And a lot of those visions were filled with family members, with cousins. A lot of us were living together in, you know, the same apartment buildings, you know, a lot of memories of being in church and really church serving as the vessel for hope, right, for our community as we went together. But we were always together with our cousins and always together with family. And we just believed that we could make it out. I didn't ever remember like our parents doubting what they could become in the United States. Like they always just, my dad and my mom, they always just kept the composure about them. Like we never saw them growing up and being like, oh, we can't make this bill or we can't make that bill. Like it was just a level of composure where we were like, all right, we're going to be all right, you know? And I think a big part of that is why my self-esteem is the way it is, because what my parents put out for us to see. You know, if they were always complaining about their situation, of course, they're traveling as refugees from a war-torn country. Like, this is, like, I know a lot of people just throw that term out there as immigrant and refugee.
But, like,
this is...
You leave everything behind when you're 30-something. And you start fresh.
Some people don't make it out. You know what I'm saying? And sometimes we just overlook that. And I'm not going to lie. As a kid, I overlooked that a lot.
Until I started myself, but I had to be here to see it. Like, okay. You know what it is, right? And I always tell people this. So whenever I get down. So our parents, your parents and my parents, one day we're just sitting in Khartoum. Like, this ain't working out.
Yeah.
I see my kids being something big in America. Like, somebody had a vision for you. You didn't. Like, my mother, one time, somebody told me a story one time when I went to Rang, they said, you know, Akal, what you're doing is not a surprise. He's like, your mother used to brag. You see my son here? He's going to be on TV in America. You see my son? Right. And people, bro, this is when they never, like, come on now. America?
Yeah.
Bro, we can't even get out. So I'm like, wait a second. Vision is what made me what I am, because somebody decided one day, like, let me get my kids, leave everything I have behind. Go to, I think you went to Cairo, right? Go to Cairo. Right. And then go to America. Let me just go to America, and guess what? our parents worked whatever they want to do, like the vision as the kids. So
right.
When we get down on ourselves, bro, somebody had a vision about you before you even started. Somebody took a risk. Like, we're never going to face something they faced. And what they faced, basically, and I always give you this example, imagine spending your whole life in Omaha or Des Moines and in your 30s with your kids. You have to leave all that and go to, like, Norway. Learn a new language, learn everything, start scratch because of your kids.
That's vision.
And imagine, like, you come to South Center. How many people do you see here didn't get a chance? When I tell people, like, I want to Okay, we're back. What's happening now?
What's going on, Nicole?
Yeah. So you were discussing how hard it is. People don't understand how hard it is for like families. Like, I was thinking about that, like changing your whole life, going to a whole other place, knowing nothing, especially being an immigrant and Black. I mean, that's a challenge.
Yeah.
What are some of those challenges you faced growing up as an immigrant in Omaha?
Yeah, you know, Omaha is a really unique place in that we really set the tone, I think, for the South Sudanese community, not only in the United States, but also globally. You know, everybody knows and, you know, puts Omaha with the South Sudanese community. It goes hand in hand. Mm-hmm. And Omaha has always been a place that has had immigrant communities, you know, come through the city. From the Italian community, where a lot of us went to school at All Saints Catholic School, St. Francis Cabrini Parish, to the Irish community, have been through Omaha, the Hispanic community. So Omaha does have a lot of culture and different communities, even African communities. We have a Somalian community. We have a Kenyan community, you know, a small but prevalent West African community as well. So, but coming in as a South Sudanese immigrant in Omaha, especially in the big numbers that we came with, there were challenges with that, you know, not only our history, but also how people viewed us. You know, we're very dark skinned, you know, so that can be threatening to some people. And growing up, you know, of course, you probably heard it time and time again. You know, people calling us African booty scratchers, and now we're, you know, we're the one. Yeah, now we're the one that everybody wants to be in front of the camera. Now we're the one that everybody, you know, wants to model, you know, but we came from that and those struggles. But we also had to fight a narrative, right, growing up that, oh, you know, you guys are just, you know, gangbangers, or you guys, you know, are violent. But it was actually the very opposite. Like, we had brilliant people that I grew up with. We still do have brilliant kids coming up in our program. We have brilliant adults, elders, like we were talking about. Like, our families came from nothing and came to the United States and were able to flourish, were able to put their kids through school, able to put their kids through college. And now their kids are showing those return on investments by taking care of their families, which is a beautiful thing. Mm-hmm. But, there was also beauty in the struggle, because we all came up together. Like, a lot of those same families that we traveled with from Egypt, from Cairo, Masr, as South Sudan, as we would say in Arabic, you know, like, we came to the United States and we found each other in Omaha. And that was a lot of beauty in that, because we had each other to, lean on in times of struggle. It's really a beautiful thing to see where we're going now, because I think Omaha has really pivoted from the community that everybody stays away from to now the community that everyone looks up to and is really looking to as the community that's leading the charge. We've embraced that here in Omaha, and other communities in Nebraska have followed as well. Lincoln's doing an incredible job. Manchester, New Hampshire is another community that Ross Leaders is in, is doing an incredible job. We're starting to do incredible things in Dallas, in Des Moines, Iowa. Awal is leading the charge there. In St. Cloud, we have JJ leading the charge there with, along with Quok. So we just got amazing leaders all around the country. But, I think the story of Omaha is a story that a lot of times gets overlooked, but it's where it all started. We're so happy to see where it's at now.
Okay. So, I can deduce that, because I want to understand how. So your upbringing really navigated and guided what you do now at Ross Leaders.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so you talked about your childhood, university, we got into that. But what really made you want to do Ross Leaders? I mean, something unique. What inspired you to do that?
Yeah, Cole. It was, really a vision that I believed in. Like I said, when we were growing up, a lot of people looked down on us. And I always, as a competitor, I'm like, we're just as good as anybody else, as if not better, And so I wanted the kids that were coming up to have that same kind of mentality, not only when they were in the, on the basketball floor, but when they're in the classroom, now when they're in the professional world, like to be able to believe that, you can be the very best at what you want to do. But then also in just recognizing and being honest with where our community was, we weren't headed towards the right trajectory at the point in which, when we started Ross, we weren't going the right direction. There were, I think, a lot of barriers that we had in front of us in which we didn't have the right resources to overcome. And so in creating Ross, this was the platform in which we would be able to, come together. We'd be able to unite amidst all the division that our community had, whether that had been from back home or whether that had been from people separating when they got here to the United States. We were able to bring our communities together. And there's also other South Sudanese communities in Omaha and organizations that were also doing that same thing. And so it was a beautiful thing of all of us as young people recognizing exactly the challenges that we had and how to get ahead of those challenges, having the vision to say, okay, if we're able to create these programs for our youth of today, then tomorrow we will see them pay off. And today, this is what we see, is that investment of time, of resources that we made into our kids, when they were seventh and eighth graders, we're seeing that times two today, because now there's more kids who want to be like those positive role models in which our kids have become. Today, over 50 students in college, we have countless Division I basketball players, Division II basketball players, JUCO players. Not only that, but also students who are achieving at very high levels in their fields of study, and students who are receiving full ride scholarships, and mentors who are continuing to pave the way for them. So it's a really positive thing and a powerful thing that's happening in our communities across the country that really needs to now be highlighted, because we've seen all the negative things come out about South Sudan. We've seen the narrative that they've written on us. We've seen the stories, and the victors have written those stories. Now it's time for us to write that own story, our own story, because now we're in a place where we're starting to be the victors ourselves. So, we got to start writing our own story.
Okay. We need to start writing our own story. I like that. So kind of just give us a rundown of Ross Leaders, of What do you do? What are some of your programs? And what are some of the things that your deliverables and your goals that you've achieved and the goals you want to achieve?
Yeah, so Ross Leaders, we specifically do four different things for our youth. And when we started Ross, and we were kind of in this round table, me and several other leaders from our community started it. You know, me, Edward Chang, Agoka Rope, when we're sitting there, we're talking about, you know, and Sam Laurel and Sam Idra, and we're all talking about where we want to see our community going. We stepped back and we said, okay, what is going to bring our community together? And, you know, with all the war and division that our families were facing, this was kind of trickling here to the United States. And in our community in Omaha, people weren't getting together as often. Families, you know, were kind of getting separated because all of our churches would close. And this is where everybody would gather every Sunday.
Why were they closed?
It was just different things. The Catholic diocese here were just, you know, closing the churches that we were going to. I can't get into the specifics of why, just because I don't know the details. But unfortunately, they were just being closed from St. Patrick's to ICC. So we're being moved. And now we're sitting here in 2018 and our community rarely gets together. So we stepped back. We asked ourselves, how can we unite our community again? And we're like, it's going to happen through the kids. And number one, we don't have kids, so we can't say what's going to unite the parents necessarily, but we do have younger brothers, younger sisters, younger cousins that we mentor, and we know what they're going to be facing moving on in their journey and in their life because we experienced those things. So we said, okay, although we don't have kids, what do we know that all of our parents want for us? And it comes down to four things. One, every parent wants their kid to be educated. Every parent wants their kid to have the best academics, have the best shot for their future. So we said, all right, we're going to be doing academic support. Now, today, that looks a lot different than just, you know, sitting down and tutoring a kid. That looks like maybe having STEM programming. That looks like, maybe having someone come in and speak about their career. That looks like, doing creative learning for students through arts and crafts. It could look, you know, very different depending on what the students show interest in. So we provide academic supports. That's number one. Number two is overall health and wellness. Like I said, we started off basketball heavy. However, we wanted our students to know that they could be exposed to more than basketball. So, you know, today we have a volleyball program that's coming up in Lincoln. We have students who participate in, you know, track and field. We have students, this past spring, I took two students out golfing and they said, hey, we want to start a golf club. So, you know, in the future, we're going to have a golf club. But then the overall health and wellness, it also combines that mental aspect to it too. And so having that, being mentally fit, but then also being physically fit. And we provide both of those aspects to our students. And there's another part to that overall health and wellness, right? Is when you are an athlete and you're able to be in that position to where your coach is constantly pushing you and your coach is being hard on you and your coach comes in day after day after day and shows their consistency and care for you. When you're going through hard times outside of the basketball court or outside of the football field or, you know, beyond the lines of the track and field, you're going to come back to that coach and you're going to be able to open up to them because they've seen you at your most vulnerable positions. And that's what we've seen with our kids who, you know, we train in the athletic realm. They'll come back to us when they're going through hard times outside of life, because that's where they feel most comfortable with people who've challenged them and pushed them through the most challenging parts of their life. So for me, I look at that as, you know, a kid being fully, you know, over, you know, in their over fully, fully supported in their pursuit to being mentally healthy, right? Is you have your mental and your physical health combined with one another. And then we create these spaces for students to open up to us as, you know, their mentors. But then we also open up to our students about hard times that we go through. And then this creates a conversation where everyone feels comfortable, not forced to have these tough conversations on mental health. So that's our second thing. The third thing is cultural engagement. Most of our kids are being born here in the United States, and so they are going to be facing different challenges than we faced. As you know, we're born in South Sudan, we came over to the United States, and although we were young, a lot of what our families went through were passed to us. Although we don't necessarily remember it, we went through it. You know, we were those kids that were put on their backs as they were running. We were those kids that they brought with them over to the United States. And, you know, when they were in high pressure situations, we felt that we are that. So when our parents talk about it, it's not too far removed from us. And when we go back to South Sudan, we see it and we're like, wow, all those things that our parents were saying were real, you know. But mm-hmm. Now when you take that from the perspective of a kid who was born here in America, they didn't have to go through those same challenges. You know, when we were growing up, we saw our mom and our dad struggle, but, you know, we knew that there was a certain level of responsibility on us to also make it out, you know, mm-hmm. Because our parents could only do so much. And we knew that. We understood that. Now, kids in America, their challenges are different. You know, their parents are in a position now where they can give them more. And that's a beautiful thing. But things are getting gifted very easy to these kids. And there's a level of entitlement that comes with that. But now, this is where Ross comes in. We check that, right? Like, we challenge our kids. We challenge our adults to think differently about how these kids are growing up here in America. And when we feel that our kids are, you know, acting entitled, we let them know, hey, don't forget where you came from. You know, don't forget our culture. Don't forget our values. And I think our kids accept that better than most may think because they keep coming back, right? And I think they want that level of accountability and they want to keep their culture and they want to keep those South Sudanese values. And so that's the other part that we bring into this. And then as well, we create spaces for parents to come and show their kids the culture, whether it's through our Winter Wonderland Gala, which we'll be having coming up December 16th in Lincoln, where, you know, parents and kids get to come together and enjoy the culture. And, you know, parents lead traditional dances and, you know, we have our foods and, you know, and our elders speak. And so creating these spaces where we keep that South Sudanese celebratory culture alive. And that's going to be big moving on to the next generation, because those are things that can be lost when our parents are gone, especially if we're here in America and we're not preserving that. Mm-hmm. Then the fourth one is where it gets fun, Nicole, is career exploration, right? And I've talked to you about this too. There have been really great individuals who have been able to succeed in their journey of being a South Sudanese American first generation immigrant. Yes. And they're doing incredibly, they're performing incredibly well in their specific fields. However, there's no link between them and the younger generation coming up, because a lot of times there's an amount of sacrifice that you have to make in order to pursue your own career endeavors. And so what we want to do at Ross is be the bridge to that person who is doing tremendous in their own field and connect them with that student who also has interest in that similar field. And so that looks like matching up, you know, a young lady or a young man who's really interested in law. You know, we have incredible lawyers throughout the country who are excelling in that field. And so connecting them, you know, with those lawyers. Yourself, someone who's in business, international business in South Sudan, I'd love to connect you with some of our young men and our young women who are entrepreneurial in their endeavors and in their interests. So, and also whether that be the health field as well, you know, incredible South Sudanese figures who are accomplishing in that field and all fields really. And so what we want to do is connect our youth to professionals who are doing things at a really high level so that they can have that same network that other people enjoy here in America.
Wow. It's really inspiring.
Yeah.
I really like the multi-layered approach to the ROS leaders, particularly of identifying that it's not just enough to help somebody get into college. Let's say education. You want to help somebody prepare an ACT, SAT, college application. Excellent. They get into college. They're going to need support to get through college. Once they're out of college, I mean, this is going to be a 3-4 year experience. They don't know what they want to do. Some are going to go to graduate school, law school, medical school, pharmacy school, etc. Someone enters the job market, someone too, they don't know. But what I find most interesting is that the real mentorship and the real support comes after somebody has done the needful. It comes after somebody has said, well, since kindergarten until 12th grade, I did my best. I went to college, I performed well. Now what? That's when we really need to get these kids, because many of the times I see there's going to be kids who, from an early on age, they just don't have the attitude. It's going to be difficult to get to them. It's okay. Sometimes it's a challenge. There's going to be kids who want to be mentored, want to be guided, but it's really easy to guide and mentor somebody when something is really black and white. So you find a high school junior and they're like, hey, I need guidance. You just tell them, do you want to go to college or not? Yeah, I want to go to college. Okay, apply for college. Do your ACT. Do your applications. Write down the schools you want to go to. Do you want to go to your UNO, UNL, Creighton, etc.? Get your FAFSA signed up. Do you want to go in-state, out-state? All these things. Okay, once they get to college, like, what next? Well, do you want to do a major? Or what do you want to study? You want to study finance, political science, economics, biology, chemistry? What do you want to do? You know what? I don't want. Okay, you know what? Find a major. Okay, then after 4 years, they're like, okay, I've done everything. I have my bachelor's. What now? We don't have people at that area to tell them what now then, because somebody then is like, well, actually, I don't know what now. You come and help me, help other people. Then it's like, but if we have to say, okay, you graduated, we need to get you an entry-level job, or we need to get you a mentor who can help you navigate the corporate ladder. Because one thing, and I always say this, a lot of people don't understand it, the most vicious place that you can be in is the corporate world. The corporate world epitomizes everything wrong about America and everything great about America. What I mean by that is that the corporate world rewards excellence and extreme riggedness and commitment. So if you're somebody who was used to not being challenged and not used to contact, let me just say contact in the professional world, when you get to the corporate world as an entry-level position, it's going to be tough. You need a mentor. And I get it a lot with a lot of some of these people that I try to mentor here. It's like, well, they get to a job, like, well, I feel like some of my people, they don't like me because I do a good job. I'm like, yeah, they're not going to like you. It's okay. Oh, they get into realize, like, I'm losing friends from college and high school because I'm working so much. It's okay. Or, you know, my high school sweetheart or college sweetheart broke up with me. You know, it's like, it's okay. Or, you know, I moved to my own apartment. This is the first time in my life I'm living alone and paying bills. Like, there's some people who've never paid bills. They don't even know how to do a basic, you know, taxes. Okay. People need help adulting. That's what they really need help in, because adulting is longer. Like we said earlier, adulting can be 30, 40 years, you know.
Yeah.
God give us a long life. It'd be longer. Yeah. But high school is 4 years. College is four years. 8 years. No. Okay, after 8 years, what are you going to do with a bunch of... You got them high school, you know, diplomas and bachelor's degrees.
Yes.
How are you going to make them to be successful members of the society? Because what's so crazy to them, they believe they've reached the finish line. I have my bachelor's. Or let's say I went to law school. Great. But they don't realize that what you're doing from kindergarten until your senior year of college is a prerequisite. It's like in basketball, like it's a scrimmage. Like you played five scrimmages. Then, wait a second, we've been playing 10 scrimmages. It's not the game. No, the game, the first, we played 5 and 10 scrimmages. Or we train from July until October, and the first game is in the end of October. Then what have we been doing since July or the summer? Yeah. All these games, they don't count. All that they do doesn't count. right? And you get the instance where you find people in the corporate culture facing challenges because they're so used to academic equating their success with academic excellence without realizing that academic excellence is merely something that gets you into the door.
Yeah.
So
that's what
they need to teach. You know what I mean? I'm trying to get your mind thinking.
100%.
So how does the Ross Leaders help with that? Because we want these young kids to be leaders in 20, 30 years. We don't want them to. Yeah. They're going to graduate college. They're going to get their master's. They're going to be doctors. There's going to be masters. There's going to be lawyers, engineers. How do we mentor them to deal with life? To know that, hey, you're going to do this for 25 years.
Right.
You're going to stuck on one company.
You said some key things there. But one of them is the prerequisite part. All of those scrimmages, all of those practice leading up to the game, those matter. You know, all of those reps that you're putting in, reading when you're preschooler, when you're a third grader, when you're a sixth grader, when you're eighth grader, when you're, you know, 10th grader, 12th grader in college. All of those assignments, those are, you're building your habits throughout all of that. And so, encouraging and being honest with our students and letting them know, like, if you are messing around at these levels and if you're not handling business, you are going to pay for it later. And that does one of two things. Number one, it's being honest with them. So hopefully, you know, they get alerted and make changes. Number two, if they don't, they still have hope for the future because someone put that seed in them at a very early age. Someone let them know, hey, these are the realities of the world, you know? And that's one of the things I tell a lot of people, like, especially as I'm mentoring students and I'm doing community work, people just aren't honest with kids, okay? And we pay for it in society. We pay for it in society. And then everyone wants to complain about it later. And it's because you're just not being honest with these kids. You have to be honest. And the kids can, they can accept the truth. A kid is only going to be able 100%. A student is only going to learn what you teach them, you know? And, you know, we like languages, right? We speak three languages, you know? We learned all these languages when we were young. Think about how hard it is to learn a language when you're an adult versus when you're a kid. When you're a kid, and your brain is forming. These ideas are starting to, you know, become a part of your life, a part of your journey. And if you don't learn them when you're a kid, then it's a lot harder to learn than when you're an adult. And that's the biggest reason. What people ask, you know, Jacob, why would you name a mentoring and youth program Ross Leaders after a country? And I, you know, I get it. It's a weird thing. It's different, right? But it starts when
it starts there.
Yeah. Look, it starts when they're kids. And this is how we have to train our kids is, hey, look, yeah, we have other areas where we can have fun. And, you know, we'll explore the opportunities that you could potentially, you know, turn into a profession. Don't get me wrong. Like, we'll go to, you know, we just have other opportunities for our kids to, you know, engage in. But we're training them to become serious about their craft and whatever they choose to do. So whether that be, you know, you want to explore creative arts. Okay. Bet. Like, we have one of the best artists in Omaha and, you know, probably around the country, well-renowned artist who comes and teaches our kids art. You know, we have professional athletes, if our kids are really interested in taking sports seriously, who come back and give feedback to our kids. We have people from professional industries, law, business, et cetera, who come back and give our kids their experience because kids can take it. They can learn it if you're willing to teach it. And there's another point about, and I don't want to forget this, about what you said about first generation and learning things for the very first time. Our parents came here and they didn't know what it was like to be raised as a youth in the United States. They just figured it out. No experience. And they don't know what it is to be a kid in the United States. They know what it is to be a kid in Juba. They know.
Or even
what
the
it,
village.
In the village, right? And what happens in the village, Akola?
It's so raising different.
You're raising the kids together, you know, like you have, if you do something wrong, you know, our parents probably told us the story 100 times. If you did something wrong and someone caught you on the road, you're going to get a whooping there.
Yeah.
you're gonna get a whooping at your cousin's house, at your uncle's house, all the way until you get home. I don't even know how this news traveled, you know, when people don't have the phone. So but this news somehow traveled.
But whether hold on, it was, Jacob. Well, yeah. Let's continue this card. Let's take a guys, we're back. The conversation is getting interesting and getting fun. What he's saying, you know, when people grow up in the village, you grow up in a communal setting where everybody there is related to you. Your mom's cousin, your dad's cousin, all this. So you grow up in a setting where you feel safe and secure. That's why you notice South Sudanese, we wanted to stay around each other when we first came, but you notice we came distant from each other because, like, wait a second, it's not the same, right? I said we called each other cousins and relatives because we wanted to replicate that, right? So with parents, they don't know what it's like. Like, even they'll be like, well, I don't know why you guys are so hung up on sports. When we grew up, sports weren't a requirement. I'm like, because it's different. Because when you grew up in a situation where everybody looks like you and related to you, the game was right behind your house. I remember the house my dad was in that. The soccer field was right by his house. I told him, it's like these Khawaja, it's like, their parents won't attend the game, but they know the coaches. They know everything. The same way you guys can say, oh, yeah, Jacob's the coach. I know Akal. Like, people don't understand that these settings, they grew up in. Like, here in South Sudan, I know people who have insurance companies. I know people who have companies that do different types of businesses. South Sudanese look like us. When we get to America, it's a whole different ballgame. So they didn't know what it's like to grow us in America as a teenager. They didn't know, like, let your friend drop you off. It wasn't a good look. It just made you guys like, you know, people like, where are your parents? Like, man, it used to be so embarrassing. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know what you mean. I know what you mean. It just became a point where it just, you know, it was just, we accepted it. Like, none of our parents were coming to the games, you know, and, you know, they weren't dropping us off. Like, somehow we would find our own way to practice. Somehow we would find our own way to games. And a lot of that is, you know, a lot of us had mentors or whatever come pick us up with friends. But to now, looking at it back as an adult, and I'm thinking, like, when I have my family, like, I can't imagine not attending my kids' games.
Yeah, that's, you know, and I mean? Also, like,
or like, they not being supportive, and also, like, my kids.
They complain, like, why are we spending so much money on shoes? Yeah, and, like, I used to play football. We used to have to get cleats and gloves.
Yeah,
what is this? We used to play one sport. So I'm like, damn, you know, like, so, like, you think, like, man, I can't ask him for basketball shoes and football
you
cleats.
Can't.
So this is what
can't.
I'm going to do this year.
Yeah.
I'm using my football cleats for last year, and then I'm going to get new basketball shoes.
Yeah.
But, like.
But you know what, Akal? I will say, too, that creates a different kind of chip on your shoulder when you're growing up and you don't have necessarily the same support as maybe your competitor. You know, it gives you an edge. Although you have less, it does give you an edge. Like, I remember,
it gives you a big time edge.
Yo, Akal, our games when we were coming up, especially when it was all of us, as far, like, we grew up with, man, we were 40 deep sometimes, you know? And when we grew up with, we had one team, Akal, where it was all South Sudanese players, like, at our school team. Like, it was all South Sudanese players. Some of the best times. One of my friends just sent me a picture of it. He just sent me a picture of it today. And Akal, we had such a chip on our shoulder, man, where we came in. And we had the same shoes that we were wearing from outside, or, you know, that one shoe that we got during the year. And the guy across had these brand new Kobe's on. You know what I'm saying? Like, we would smack those teams by 30. You know what I'm saying? Like, we just had that kind of edge because we knew our parents couldn't support us, and we didn't hold that against them. Instead, we just couldn't. Went harder. And as a matter of fact, the call, it kind of helped us because it wasn't like, man, our parents were chirping at us. Like, these other players, their parents are yelling at them from,
yeah, you didn't from, notice Billy from the stands.
Like, all this. We didn't have all that. We were just focused on winning, bro, the game. You know, like, you know, it's kind of an advantage. Come,
they'll be on the phone outside talking.
Like, yeah, then, yeah. That's my,
hey, the Hajime David then. You know, yo, they're like, I didn't need my, then, you know, I'm going to this person's.
Yep, yeah, it's like, less okay. pressure. It's less pressure on
it
you.
It is,
right?
Less pressure.
You're not like, trying to. You're not trying to prove anything to your parents. You know, you're just going out there. You're playing. You're learning the principles of the game, and you're just trying to dominate the game. So, yeah, man, it was. It's definitely.
And then
different.
Also, like, I feel as if like people don't get like having the chip on your shoulder of like different things. You're just like, man, like I gotta. It's for me. Because
yeah.
me being here, even if I decide to just be a regular Joe, work a regular job in the U.S. for the rest of my life, it'd be okay. Because they're like, we brought you here, you get your high school. But it's like, the most dangerous, I would say, we're going to become is our generation, like our kids. Because like, we have that chip, and then we also, like, there's emotional intelligence that we know how to deal with the kids. Also, that what they're going through in school. Because they wouldn't realize, like for example, like people don't get this. Our parents didn't experience racism from white people. We did. Like, these are people, they would go to Khartoum, yes, but like they would stay in their area. So when you tell them, yeah, these, you know, white people are racist, what do you mean? What do you mean? Like, what do you mean racist? Explain
man,
to me.
Okay, like, they don't like me because I'm a black. Different man. They see to that. This is one of the things for our parents. When something affects you, it's physical, you know.
It's physical.
Like, it's physical. Like, it's either you getting whooped or you getting somebody throwing a rock at you in Cairo, you know, like.
Yeah.
It's physical. They don't understand
psychological.
And
they're
the
ones who should be like,
wait, they called you a what? They're like, you're going to get thrown off because somebody called you a name? Think of all the names I called you growing up. You know, like, and you're going to get, you know, in your feelings because somebody else is calling you a name. So our parents aren't even fazed by a lot
of the
things.
And they're like, man, you're some soft. But you know what's so crazy? And it's like, I think about it more and more. Africans, we have such thick skin because it's like,
man.
Like, I remember, like, just thinking about it. I remember there was a time I was having a conversation with an African and some, you know, Africa versus African Americans. And then one African guy said to African American, he's like, you don't get where we come from, do you? Like, we come from a place where some of our people have taken up arms to protect ourselves. Like, we've gone to war because we believe in something. Like, it's a different breed out here. And it's like, our families, the stuff that they've gone through, that they witnessed, ain't no joke. It ain't no joke.
It's real.
And it's like, I feel like one of the reasons that we came to the U.S. is that my dad used to work in the underground cells of the SPLM in SPLA. So he used to, like, hold secret meetings, translate documents that was brought by those guys of John Gooding in the area. And, like, his life was in danger. And then his brother and then my grandpa's like, you need to get out of there. So, like, imagine that. Like, you, like, and this is then, that's the cause that you believe in. You know? And so, like, people don't get that. Like, that's why it's like, our parents, they have that hunger and they have that high tolerance of bullshit. Like, I remember one time I asked my dad, he's like, yeah, so what? Somebody's going to call me nigger. Call me nigger. But he's going to pay me $20 an hour. But my family back home, that money, I can do so much for them. If this is the cost, it's okay. Right. He's like, guess what? It's better than, like, bro, there's some people here in South Sudan who make like $10 a month. I remember like when we were in Rang, like, so like there's like Yomiya daily work. Where you go, you show up, you want a day job. Bro, those bricklayers, man. So, like, I was with my late brother, and he's like, I was like, how much they make? I mean, they make like 1,000 SSDs. He's like, that's like $2 a day. He's like, and they work 10 hours a day. He's like, you mean to tell me people? I was like, that's a lot to them. That gives them bread, and they work a week. They're calculating. He's like, you mean to tell me people work that hard? What about, he's like, what about labor laws? What about, I'm like, what do you mean? Did you just show up? Like, you do what you got to do. So, like, you want some extra money? Me and you, Jacob, we go stack the bricks. They give us a small money, we're out.
100%. And Akal, a part of it is understanding the rules to the game and where you're at, you know? And, you know, we can change the game over time, but at this time, we got to play the game, you know?
And you have to play
all
the
they're
game.
Doing back home, all they're doing back home is they're playing the game. They say, okay, like, if I got to do this in order to lay these bricks, then that's what I'm going to do. If it's for $2 an hour, then that's what I'm going to do. So
$2 a day.
That is no joke. For $2 a day, you got to, man, but as they're laying those bricks, though, you would think that, you know, a few of those guys have the aspirations to one day hire the guys who are laying the bricks. And that's the kind of mentality that our parents, I think, even here, sometimes we underestimate it. Man, my dad is the hardest worker that I've ever seen. And my mom is right there, too. They work countless hours, you know, and for very little of what you would compare in the United States as a good wage, you know, but their aspirations for what they see back home is just, you know, like the sky is not even the limit. It's just a view for what they see back home. Like,
yeah,
they want to achieve great things back home, and they're pouring their investments back there because they know the game and the landscape there is going to pay better dividends than what's here in America. Our parents, I think a lot of times we see our parents here in the United States and, you know, and don't get me wrong, they're working all these jobs and they take a lot at their job, but they do still have a vision because they had to have a vision to get us here, right? So they still have a vision.
So crazy for that vision, what they foresee is what separates them from us.
Yeah, yeah. Ooh, it's a different kind of grit.
We work in a corporate. I mean, could you work in a meat factory for like 15 years or labor?
Hey man. I'm sorry, Carl. I can't do it. I'm just gonna be real,
bro.
I'm just gonna be like, real.
Our generation, you've been making like 70K, then it's like, man, fuck this job. I'm trying to come up. You know,
because this is the thing. We talk about this all the time. Me and my brother, we're like, man, like we see our dad. He's outside. He's, you know, just chilling, looking out. And yeah, he just watches. He just watches, you know, the tree and the birds, and he's just drinking his tea. And we're like, man, why does Daddy always do that? And it's because he made it. This is it for him right here. He's able to work. He's able to have his investments back home. His kids are graduating. That's it. He put his time in. So if we had to imagine going through what he went through in order to get to that point where he could finally say he made it, we'll go, man, I don't know if I can, man, 20 years being working hard labor like that and still coming out on top. Like, you have to have a different mental makeup in order to get to that point. But I think we have inhibited a little bit of that, you know, and for what we've gotten, we have to use it to our best potential, you know. And so, it's really amazing to see our parents and what they've done and what they've accomplished. But
champions.
They're a different breed. First, I understand we give them, you know, we critique them a lot. However,
we don't celebrate them enough,
to be honest.
We don't know their life in Africa. Bro, like, let me tell you something. I mean, like, I remember my dad was telling me, he's like, yeah, you know, he used to work, he used to farm himself, stay there, like, he stays in the farm for 1 month in the rain. He used to sleep in like a makeshift bed, like, and just put a mosquito net. He's like, yeah, I used to do that, and then I'd make like 50 sacks. I'm like, 50 sacks, it's like, if a sack is like $20, it's like $1,000. So it's like, you used to go work for like a month and a half to make $1,000. He's like, yeah, after the, and there's cost. I said, yeah, but it's okay. But it, so I feel like there's something that we can learn from them, and I always think about this when you make goals. Have a goal that's clear. Like, their goal was to give my kids a good education or put myself in a better life. That was just their goal, right? I mean, it wasn't like, I'm trying to have your network of this much. They're just like,
yeah.
So sometimes when you say, like, you know, when you're working to save up for something,
right?
Like, instead of thinking like, man, I'm trying to save up for a $10,000 car, but these people make $10,000 a minute. Who cares?
Right.
Focus on you, right? It's like lifting in the gym, right? When you lift in the gym, for example, you could basically deadlift, let's say 150 pounds. That's you, and that's your max, and you're proud of that. You can lift 150 pounds. And I look at Jacob, he's lifting 500. I'm like, what's that, man? What's the point of me trying? And there's people out there lifting. No, don't look at it like that. what is your journey? What is your thing? That's why it's like with cycling, like, and it taught me cycling, going to the gym, doing kickboxing, different things. Like when I was in Houston, I used to go to the Juba kickbox. I mean, not, what did I say, Juba? Houston, the Texas Kickboxing Academy.
Yeah.
So one time we're sparring, there's some small little Asian kid. The guy, like, we're sparring. This guy's like beating me, my man. This guy's good.
Yeah.
It humbles you. Like, I got to work on myself. The same thing in anything. When you're cycling, like when I cycle, we got guys on our team that are fast. I'm telling you, fast. They're there. Same thing with lifting in the gym. There's guys who are going to have nicer bodies, but like, is this the best version of yourself, right? And like, we always have to, I always do your best. And you know when you're not doing your best. You know when you're lying to yourself. You know when you put yourself and you could put yourself more. Like, you don't want to put yourself to exhaustion, but you want to push yourself and do your best. Our parents be like, we've done our best compared to, like, bro, like, this is not comparing.
Yes.
I left my home country. I went to another country. My children graduated college. Like, I'm in America, a place of America. I'm done. I have a steady job every day. I have safety. I have security. Yeah. I mean, you look at Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Yeah. I have everything.
Right.
Okay, so what?
They're not. But like, yeah, they're not even done yet.
They're not done yet. They're like, next thing you know, let me build a small house. And what I realized about, like, I always tell people this, modesty is really important. It's like, I'm a big proponent of the Stoics. Like, just have a small house, simple things. You realize the meaning in life. Like, I realize, like it's kind of like doing a podcast. Like, I'm not making money from this. I just like doing it. But what's so crazy is, like, that's how, like, I get fulfillment. Like, I like having good conversations. I like engaging with guests. I like hearing people's stories. I like having a conversation.
Gives you energy.
Like, I'm like, it gives me energy. I'm like, I like this. You know, like, you learn a lot. And as I was telling them, like, podcasting, you learn so much about people. When you talk to them in, like, an official setting, you're like, wow, I didn't know this.
Yeah, exactly. And but think of it as well, Akal. It goes back to what you said. It comes from within you. Like, you're learning because these are things that are really in you that you're finally expressing to someone else. And these ideas are finally connecting between you and someone else. And then now reaffirms why you think the way you think. That gives you energy to keep on going, right? And just in the same way that our parents, like, they have this tunnel vision type mentality of, these are my goals. I'm going to do whatever I have to do to accomplish these goals. And when I get there, I'm going to even excel even more beyond what I have imagined for myself when I started. And they're just great to look at and see that and use them as an example for that. But there's a lot of things. There's a lot of issues in our community. Don't get me wrong. And us as South Sudanese, I learned this in Juba, Cole, you're like this. I had an uncle. And, you know, in Juba, everybody talks politics in Juba. It's like in every conversation. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
it's like,
bro.
And I'm like, Uncle, like, is this all you guys, you know, you guys are talking about this, talking about this. I'm like, Uncle, he's like, listen. He said, listen, Jacob. This is Juba. This is not America. We call a spade a spade. And, you know, he's saying some things that I'm like, these are questionable things. But he's like, look, we just call it spade a spade. This is just how we do it here. And
don't talk. They have so no filter,
man.
They're just
no,
like,
they're just very. So, you know, back to what I was saying is, you know, we have a lot of issues and our people, we call it spade a spade and we call those issues out. But let us not forget about all the positive things that are also happening. And all the positive things that have come out of our struggles and our parents' struggles, because that's the only way we're going to continue on to remain successful in this journey.
Mm-hmm. And that's the thing. Yeah. Part of it is kind of like, when you look at it, there's so many things people don't understand is that one thing that our parents look at, there's a trade-off. People feel like, okay, if you stayed in South Sudan, I could have been a big politician, had a big position, become a businessman, become very wealthy. But then somebody's like, but the best thing I've done is my kids. They can do that. Mm. They can go to South Sudan. There's a guy who was, I was talking to. He was basically really resentful. He was like, oh, I should have stayed in South Sudan. Some of my people I'm with, now they're ministers, they're governors, and they're really powerful. And I'm like, but you did something. Like, it's a trade-off. And I feel like people, that's another aspect people don't think about. Like, how many of your father's colleagues and friends were in South Sudan, and then they did business, and they're in America? Like, people are like, why are you in America? And it's like, but it's okay, my kids. It's a vision. It's turning that down. But then also, it's like, and they say in Juba, we call it state to state. Another thing is that people, when they talk about politics, because they own it, people hear like, man, we're trying to like conspire to bring this guy's the mayor, bring this guy's the governor, bring this guy's the position of power. Everybody's sitting down, always like moving. But like, because you become a mover and a shaker there. Because think about it, for us, you're always going to be around movers and shakers. They're always going to be talking about moves. What's happening here? Let's align here. Yeah. Let's do this. Let's do that. Yeah. Let's do this.
Juba's a small place. You can make a lot of things happen.
You can make a lot of things. And it's like, I always tell people, like, when you come to South Sudan here, it's like, you want, like, you're here. We're in our country. We're the elites here. Like, it's easy for you to access a governor, to access a minister, to access leadership, to get involved in these different things. It's not difficult. So it's like, you're moving and shaking. That's what you're like, man, why did all these guys talk about politics? I mean, because they're always moving and shaking. They're like, man, this guy, man, he's messing up our stuff, man. He needs to go home. We're not happy with this. You know, this guy. We need to move to do this and do that. In America, we haven't reached that point. Like, America, people don't need to have access to the governor. Like, my governor, I was talking to him earlier today. Hey, you need to do this. You should do that. Yeah, okay, I'll call you, you know. It's like, talk to different people. I complain. Hey, you guys need to be doing this. Okay, I'll call you. Get it. Yeah, that. You know. And I'm always complaining. I'm like, you guys, I'm like, you guys need to just give me the job and let me show you how it's done. You know, like, you know, you just talk to them, they laugh. But it's like, when I see that here, I'm like, how come in there I don't have, like, I look at my phone. I can tell you I've had like a phone, honorable people, like a lot of people. But in America, do I have that list? Can I call a congressman, a senator, on a can I show up at his house? It's like, yo, what's up?
You know,
there's this issue I want to discuss with you.
You know, if you look at Minnesota, I think African communities in Minnesota, especially the Somalian community, has gotten to that point where they have finally understood exactly. They finally understood the power of having a united community. Because they're voting in blocks. And if you want their vote, then you're going to adhere to the resources, to the demands that they have. And if you don't, then they're going to leverage their voting power to make sure that, okay, we're going to put the right people's, you know, in position. And that's what they've done. But
that all basically, comes they're from, basically like, oh, what we're doing in, what's it called? Somalia or South Sudan.
Yeah,
why don't we just do it here? Like, why don't we apply pressure? Yeah, why don't we show up in government office? Like, bro, I don't want this guy.
And Nicole, what are you known? What are Somalians great at? They're great at business.
Business. Somalians money.
Are really great at business. And that's why, for me, I would always look at the politics that everybody would talk in South Sudan. I said, y'all are missing the point. While the Asian communities are coming here and buying up all the contracts and are building up all the, you know, infrastructure, guess what? Guess who's going to have the power? The people who are running the businesses. You know, they asked Magic Johnson, they said, Magic Johnson, you'd make for a great president. He said, yeah, but I would only have 8 years. Why wouldn't I have a lifetime of electing and, you know, funding the politics, future president that I want? So we have to stop thinking of politics as just this area where we can go and politics drink tea.
Is
and,
also business.
You know, it's about, but business is where you start. What are you going to do if you have no money? You tell me. I have to figure it out.
And it's kind of like, I realize this sometimes with like myself. Like, I worked in government briefly, but I realized in the private sector, I can influence decisions. Like, I can attend place. I just me talking like, hey, I don't want this guy. Jacob's my guy. We need to bring Jacob in. He's my guy. You know, you do more. South Sudanese, we look at the raw politics, which is important. Sometimes, like, you have to know politics without business is not business politics. Business without politics is not business. What do I mean by that? Business is that I'm in a position of power and there's a lot of road contracts. I say, Jacob, come take some work. I mean, that's how people, like, basically, like, in America, they do it like that. Like, you're the city council and you say, hey, let's start a sanitation company. You just pick up the trash. You'll make money, right? Like that. Then once you make that money, then we have other things. for us as South Sudanese, we haven't, like, we do, like, the business we do here, and I noticed, is not really market-based. It's contractual-based, where you get a contract from the government or a company. But trading, controlling the rice market. Like, I was telling somebody the other day, like, I was interested because I was doing some research, and I'm just like, there's a rice shortage, and India is no longer exporting rice. Who controls the rice market? I went around and asked. It was Darfur, Sudanese. I said, okay. I told one of my friends, I was like, write this down. Who controls the fuel market, the rice market, sugar market, flour market, cooking oil market, electronics market? He's like, but these are small. I'm like, they're not small things. It's a business, all right? Who controls the banks? Most of the banks in South Sudan, Kenya Commercial Bank, Equity Bank, which is Kenyan, Echo Bank, which is West African, Stanbic Bank is South African. People go there, all right? Whereas in a region, like, that's why I focus on agriculture. I'm like, agriculture is something that I can do and grow and be like, okay, I have an agriculture thing. But other people, when they dominate business, they say, you know what? Jacob, you control the sugar trade. I'll control the maize trade.
Yeah.
Simple. Right. And we're going to work together.
Right.
And then we bring in somebody else to control the coffee trade. Like, 100%. It's so simple, but like in 10 years, if you want, we all know everything about that commodity. Nobody can stop us. But our business in South Sudan is so entrenched with power. Like, if I'm in power, I give you a lot of contracts. Then when I'm out of power, you don't get contracts. So we fight to stay in power because it's like, that's where the money's at. But if I'm like, you know what? You guys remove me. But tomorrow I'm not going to import you sugar.
Yeah.
Like, there's a guy, during the Sudan crisis, there's a guy by the name of Ismail Daoud. He has a big, he controls the wheat market in Sudan. He controls the sugar market. He just, like, he told basically, like, he had a problem with, like, the government. He told, like, you know what? Like, when Bashir, I'm just not going to import wheat anymore. That drove the prices of bread up.
Wow.
He just said, you know what? I'm going to Dubai. I'm just not going to import wheat. And, like, this,
and nothing's moving.
That's like, right.
That's
people, you're like, man. So anytime he has a problem with the, so like, raw politics is good. But like in Africa, but in America, we have to realize, like, you have to have both. And I feel like people don't get it. Power is your wealth and your influence. You have to have both. Like, South Sudanese, we have the influence, but we don't control our own economy. I mean, you saw yourself in Juba, so many Habesh. Like, everything, the hotel market, all these markets, it's not us.
Yeah.
And this is why, like, I like the Somali.
What have you seen, Akola? What can we do to change that as a young, growing South Sudanese population? And most of our population is, you know, fairly young in South Sudan. And so what can we, and when I was in South Sudan, I met so many intelligent young men and women, especially young women, who have achieved great things in their academic careers, but really had no opportunity to get into businesses. And so even when we, you know, and sorry to answer your question for you, but, you know, here a lot of times our parents push education. But that doesn't necessarily seem to be moving, you know, the pin for us in South Sudan, because we do have educated young people.
What
do you see there on the ground as a way that we can change the direction of what's going on?
I think one of the things I would say is people, like, the other day I just did a workshop a couple of months ago on entrepreneurship, and I talked about, So I spoke at the South Sudan Association of Young Entrepreneurs. They invited me to be a guest speaker of their anniversary. And so I said something. I'm like, you guys have to understand something that's very dangerous. College graduates without jobs. All these graduates every year graduating, but where are they going to work? If we don't create jobs, we're going to be a problem. And we're a country that values education. Like, Jacob has 3 masters. He has 4 bachelors. He has a PhD. Good job. Yeah. But he's going to go end up having to go work at a farm because he has to feed his family.
Right.
We need entrepreneurs. Entrepreneurship is where the real money's at. That's where the real power is at. But if we continue to sell this narrative that if you're educated, you're okay. Like we said, like it's a prerequisite. So you have a master's, but then now what? Can you get a job? What skills do you have? Do you understand the business market? And so, like, in my field, like, in this, just like business consulting, like, I'll get, sometimes, like, I'll do, like, an internship program for somebody, and it's like, I'm like, you don't have real skills. Like, you studied, for example, a field that's good, but do you know practically, like, for example, like you study finance, but like, do you know what the financial needs of a company are? Like, what kind of finance do you need? When you go work at a company, you're going to be either in treasury, accounts receivables, accounts payables. You're going to be doing operations, budget. It's just not like, oh, I just did finance. You have to have something to sell, because a company is going to be like, let's say me and you have a company. You know what, Jacob? We need a marketing person, somebody who can do digital marketing. You know, it's very specific with defining that. So we have to, we might hire somebody who just knows how to do it instead of having a degree. And now with the global economy, everybody's just doing jobs they didn't study. Like, I never studied finance, but sometimes I'm doing financial advisor and investment advisor. Yeah. I'm advising people how to diversify portfolios in South Sudan, how to structure corporations. I didn't go to law school, but I know, I can tell you how to structure corporations in South Sudan, register a company, all these different things, make sure to compliance.
Because you have repetition.
It's because I'm in the market. Right. It's the point where even sometimes my lawyer, I'll draft the things for them. And I'm like, right. I'll draft the thing. I'm like, hey, you guys need to write this out. Oh, but come on, I'm gonna just do it.
Yeah.
Like, I draft them, like, just sign it, Sam, here.
Just sign it.
I'm like, I've already reviewed. And I used to review the contract detail because it's like, so the lawyer's like, why are you so tedious? I'm like, because I'm losing money. I have to review those money, because he's like, what do you, I was like, every clause, like, oh, should this happen, we terminate. I'm like, no. This clause, let's sit down. And I remember one time I had, like, our team, we're trying to sign, like, a sale agreement. Like, it was like a contract to supply, it was a consulting contract. So we're supposed to, like, sell consulting services. And it's like, I was trying to find a loophole to place to, like, allow us to leave the contract. If it doesn't, like, you know, just different things. And I'm just reading, I'm like, Lord, you need to find a way to make this happen. Because basically, when you have some of these work, is that really smart lawyers will structure it. It's like, let me give you an example. When you find, like, a coach, like, look at the coach of Texas A&M. His contraction, his lawyers are so smart. He's going to get paid for 5 years. Really smart teams will be like, look, we're going to pay you in performance. If we terminate the contract, then we have the right to just no longer pay you. But then there's a condition that if you terminate my contract before a certain date, before the guaranteed date, that's why, for example, MBA guaranteed contracts, right? You still pay me the contract value.
Correct.
So let's say I hire you as a consultant and I'm paying you $10,000 a month, right? And let's say I'm a company in the US. You can basically, I can fire you after 3 months. And if it's a 1 year contract, I have to pay you the remaining balance of 9 months, which is like $90,000, and you'll get that. People scam it. So I remember I used to study this because I would see other companies let go people but still have to pay them. I'm like, damn, then what's the point? Because you let go somebody because of a financial decision. So number one, you're going to hire somebody in Jacob's place, still pay Jacob and pay that person. You've increased your, you know, your what's it called? Your revenues. Your overhead is higher now.
Mm-hmm.
I'm getting into business. This is good. So those are things that, like, people don't, you get what I mean? Like, you get it when you're there. Like, you experience it. Like, we need to be careful how we sign these agreements. Or I'm going to hire you as an at-will.
Yeah.
And every month is renewable. And so every month I have the right to decide if I want to fire you. And it's harsh. Right. But it's a protection of the company, because I got to protect my business.
See, Akal, and there is a certain amount of risk that you had to weigh before you start to get in this, you know? Mm-hmm. And part of that risk is learning, you know, failing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Time and time again, and probably sometimes losing money, you know, where you had to get in the game and you had to experience these things for yourself, to where now you're telling your lawyers, like, hey, I have to review this because I'm losing money on it, you know?
Yeah.
And so I think a part of that too, like, people have fear in that, you know, they're like, yo, I'd rather be comfortable with just being in my theoretical space of learning. And unfortunately, in South Sudan, it's not like you can just go to a corporation where you can go and work 20 years like we can here in the United States, you know? Mm-hmm. And a lot of that is because, yeah, sure, people want to, probably a lot of people in corporate America that want to start their own business, but at the same time, they're not willing to take that risk of failing tremendously in order to one day succeed and have that type of success that their CEO has, or that the founder of their organization has.
It's and not also, an when easy, you fail, you learn so much. It's not an
easy thing to do. Yeah, yeah. Because that's where the
since
learning
I come
happens.
To South Sudan,
the learning happens when you fail. Like, I can't tell you how many times we've failed at Ross and we've questioned things that we do, but we get back up and we say, no, 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 this is for generations to come. This is not only for us. This is not only for the next. You know, you see a lot of South Sudanese nonprofits, and they're not very successful because once the leadership is turned over, there's always some type of crash that happens in the organization. And when you have such a long-term view of your organization, you will not let that happen. The only option is to learn from your failures. You're back against, there is no going back. You're only going forward. And that's a hard mindset to have, especially, you know, if you're getting into business in a place like South Sudan where, you know, there is no blueprint. Or is there? Maybe you can answer me that for me. There is no blueprint. It seems like the reason why a lot of, you know, outside businesses are coming in is because they're like, oh, we have this experience in our country and we're able to just bring it here. And right now we need more risk takers in South Sudan.
Let me tell you something with that. Like me, I've started as an entrepreneur sometimes. I've started like 3-4 projects that failed within the last 2-3 years. Failed. Like I had one that was just bankrupt and I had to just let people go. And it's like, yeah, it's like I had wanted to do a project and I had to raise some money for it. And it's like, and then in the middle, my financier was having issues with their board. And it's like, they just stopped funding me. I'm like, oh my goodness. So I'm like, okay, well, I have all these assets. What do I do with it? And I had a rent. So I'm just like, bro, I'm just going to let you guys go and then just work from home. That's part of the business. Like I've done, like, man, I'm just failing. And I learned so much. So next time, I'm like, let me do this. There's no blueprint in South Sudan because we don't have a business culture. Many people, there's two types of businesses. I mean, you have your contractual business where you get a contract and you provide a goods or service to a bank, to a company. Like me, my consulting work, like I'm in the market. Then you're selling a good to the open market, retail and wholesale. The Somalis, the Kenyans, Ugandans, Sudanese, they just like, wait, we did this in our country. Yeah. Let's just go there, set up a supermarket, just sell stuff. I mean, think about it like this, right? Look at the biggest companies in America. It's very simple business model. What is Walmart? Walmart is just selling you retail company. Amazon is an online retail company. Microsoft is just a software company. It sells software. That's how it started.
Yep.
Like, there's no company has some convoluted, esoteric, complex business model. It's a really very, like, what does Berkshire Hathaway do? It just buys shares in companies it believes are going to be worth something and then waits to get its ROI.
Nothing. There's nothing new under the sun. There's
nothing is new under the sun.
And that's why, you know, even though we don't have a blueprint, we do have an opportunity because we can create the blueprint, right? Mm-hmm. Like, and I think we have to take that very seriously as South Sudanese, but both, you know, in the diaspora and back home, is like, how can we collaborate and use both what we've learned here and the experience that we've, you know, our brothers and sisters have on the ground in South Sudan to start creating real wealth for not only our own countrymen, but for the future of our South Sudanese here in America and in South Sudan. And that's, I think that's when we're going to start seeing some real special happening. And I think it's going to start happening. Like, this is the point now, because we've been here in the United States 20, 30 years. And a lot of our parents are now going back home to where they're like, okay, how can I start investing back home? And hopefully this, you know, we continue to see South Sudan as a country grow. And I think soon, you know, we're on the cusp of our country really taking off.
Yeah. And I think many people just have to see it's an attitude, and we just have to, like I said, everything is a verb. We just have to keep doing it and do it. And you learn as the way, I mean, it's basic basketball. Watch your film. You're going to learn so much from film study. You're like, oh yeah, you know, I didn't make that good play, you know?
Yeah. We're going to make mistakes along the way.
And you have to learn it.
It is a part of it. But we got to keep a positive mindset through it all.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, like they asked Warren Buffett, you know, like, how have you become so successful? And, you know, I don't agree with this, but he says a lot of it is luck. The time that he was born and where the United States market was and where he was born.
him being born in the United States. You could have been born, and he could have been born anywhere else in the world, and he would not have gotten the opportunity that he's got. But look at what we have now. We have a country that's 12 years old. We are at our infancy stage as a country. This is a great opportunity for us
to make investments
as South Sudanese, to make investments in our own country. Well, hey, Akol, if other people are seeing it as an opportunity, why don't we?
Because we don't think about it like that. We don't think in terms of how commercial-minded, like many South Sudanese are political-minded. I want a position, but people don't see that the politics, like even the people in power, they don't see like, oh, selling sugar?
Well,
you know, like...
But I will say this too. Sorry to cut you off. But just because there is politics involved in it, if you are giving jobs to people, if you are creating businesses, if you are creating opportunities, this is going to put the right pressure on the politicians to kind of say, oh, okay, we need to get this together. Because you don't want to disrupt a thriving economy where now your citizens are saying, oh, okay, we made the turn. This is our new normal. You know, this is our new norm for what we want in South Sudan. We have to keep pushing that. Although it does not exist right now, we have to keep pushing that. And that's what we have to envision. You know, imagine right now, you will never see, you know, let's just say, hopefully we never see it. In America, can you imagine if there was war on America's land? Like, no, they would not allow that to happen. Why? Because our new norm is freedom. Our new norm is economic opportunity. We have to think of our new norm in South Sudan being that. And people have to see themselves as, okay, like if we want to see real change in the politics of South Sudan and in the government, well, they have the responsibility to at least create the foundation and the infrastructure for people to do business. But we have to put pressure as well and continue to drive positivity so that they have no option but to keep peace in the country.
I think that's so true. And it's like, because I want to wrap it up. Let me ask you this, right? You say that in America, there's a new norm where it's not in their interest to create havoc, create nonsense.
Yeah. Right.
I always said that when there's an ownership aspect to it, it's different. And so I was having a conversation with somebody, and basically that person was talking about the need to wage war sometimes. And I told them it's really not that deep. So I told them I don't think anybody should be allowed to wage war without having, you know, assets. He's like, what do you mean? I was like, you can be on Facebook instigating conflict, instigating drama, but when you have assets, when you have investments, you won't be like that. Because you're like, if conflict happens,
you got skin in the game.
I have skin in the game. So I used to tell him, I was like, when you have skin in the game, it's a different ball game. You're like, okay, it's no reason for me and Jacob to be beefing. Hey, how do we solve this?
Let's work this out.
It's really just, it hurts all of us. It does nothing for us. But you have so many people who don't have skin in the game in South Sudan or in the US creating havoc, speaking so aggressive, like, yeah, we need to do this. And it's like, come on now, man. You're not going to come and fight. What do you think our people need to do to have an owner's mindset, to be owners, if it's in the U.S. or in South Sudan?
No, I don't know collectively what our people need to do, but I know what I am going to do.
Yeah, you know, share that with us.
And I think it's important to differentiate that, because we have to look within. We have to look within ourselves. Why is it that we want to always create conflict? Why? You know, why can't we settle things in a discussion? Why does it have to get to the point where we have to get confrontational? You know, and that's a personal thing that everyone needs to look within themselves and go, oh man, this is a personal problem that I have. Or, you know, trauma that I have from my past that I need to unpack. And so for me personally, it's all about controlling the things that I can control. And I think collectively, if we all control the things that we can control, we will move on and have a better future. But if we keep trying to have an input on what everyone else's situation is, then we're going to continue to be in the position that we're in South Sudan. And, you know, it's unfortunate, you know, and you know, and especially in what we've seen in South Sudan and you know, all the wars that we've been through and all the blood that have been shed, you know, that's a lot. That's a lot of trauma that our people have gone through. Don't get me wrong. That should not, and that should not be dismissed. But we have to be looking forward into a better future for us all collectively. No matter where you're at, you're from in South Sudan, we have to look forward and say, okay, in the next 20, in the next 30 years, where do we want to see our kids and our kids' kids and our kids' kids' kids? What position do we want to see them in? And the decisions that we make today, personally and collectively, as a community, is going to determine that. It is going to determine that 100%. So before you engage in conflict, this is would be my message, is think about that. You know, think about this decision you're making influencing your great-great-grandchildren, because it will, you know, in some way, shape, or form, it will determine their futures. And if you're okay with that decision that you're making, whether if it's, you know, it results in conflict or not, then okay, you can live with that. So, yeah, I think we're going to have to address it on an individual basis and control what we can control in order for our country collectively and move forward.
Okay, that's good. Now, as I always do, I want to know, what is your final message to our listeners? Your final message to South Sudan? One message that you have.
I think my final message, and it kind of encompasses everything that we've been talking about, is to have and to maintain a positive mindset through it all. Like I said, we're people who've been through so much, and we have so much work that really needs to get done. But we have to remain persistent. We have to remain positive on this journey. And that's the only way we're going to get there. Let's use everything that we've learned from our past, from our history, from our upbringing, and let's use that all as fuel to the fire to move forward to a better future for us here in the United States, but also for our country as a whole. So we got to remain positive. We got to push through. We got to remain persistent. And the future is very bright. I see it every day. I see it every day in our South Sudanese kids. And that's what keeps, you know, me positive. That's what keeps the drive for me. So control what you can control, remain positive, remain persistent, and we will have a better South Sudan moving forward.
You heard that, ladies and gentlemen, from the one and only Mr. Jacob. Now, Jacob, if some of our listeners want to know more about Ross Leaders, do you have a website, a link?
Yes, absolutely.
How they can donate and support? Please share that with them.
Yeah, please, if you want to learn more about Ross Leaders, you can follow us on Instagram, ross.leaders. Also, you can follow So Elite. That's our partner program. Also, if you want to learn more about our programs, www.rossleaders.com. You can find out, you know, if we're in a city near you, and you can find out about our future events coming for, you know, coming up. So we'd love to have you there. Please feel free to reach out. You know, we're always looking to grow our community and our support base. So, yeah. And thank you for having me, Nicole. I love this, facilitating these conversations with South Sudanese Minds. So I really appreciate it.
Thank you. All right, guys, as always, we love you guys. We love South Sudan. Continue to be great. This is it with our brother Jacob. You guys, all the best.